On the phone from Coromandel, I have Jeanette Fitzsimons, who was up until recently the co-leader of the New Zealand Green political party. Since leaving politics, Jeanette has found herself drawn back into ecological concerns with the news that Solid Energy, a state-owned enterprise, is going to mine in an area estimated to have 6 billion tonnes of low-grade, highly polluting lignite coal. Kia ora, Jeanette. Thank you for coming on the program today.
Kia ora, Tim. Kia ora, listeners.
Jeanette, I'm positive New Zealanders know very little about this coal mining situation due to the many media distractions to keep our minds focused on other things, especially indulgences. Can you explain what is happening, just like you did 18 months ago when you first heard of this?
Well, let's start with the big picture, Tim. New Zealand is poised on the brink of the most enormous extraction of fossil fuels of all kinds that we've ever seen in our history. On the one hand, we have all of the ocean areas adjacent to New Zealand being opened up for deep sea oil drilling. This is oil drilling at up to twice the depth of the Mexico Deepwater Horizon well, which blew out so spectacularly with billions of barrels of oil lost into the sea. We've already had an exploration ship off the East Cape, and we've got areas in off Canterbury, off Golden Bay, many parts of New Zealand where government is imploring other countries, oil explorers, to come and look and see what they can find here. That is a serious risk to the ecology of the ocean from spills and blowouts, and of course, it's a lot of climate-changing gas as well. Then we've got coal. Coal is the worst of the fossil fuels for producing carbon dioxide, nearly twice as much carbon dioxide per unit energy as gas, and quite a lot more than oil. We've had coal mining in New Zealand for a long time, and down the west coast of the South Island, the Buller Plateau particularly, there is some very high quality coal, coking coal, that's used for steel making. And there's been a mine for many, many years at Stockton on the Buller Plateau, which is a nightmare of a place when you visit it. Highly polluting, does terrible things to the rivers and streams. And they're wanting to move steadily down that plateau along the coast and getting out more coal. This is virtually all for export to Japan, India, China, and a number of other places. The latest application is from an Australian company called Bathurst Resources, which has changed its name to Buller Coal to make it sound a little bit more local and friendly, but it's still an Australian company. And they have applied for consent to open up a 6 million tonne open cast pit at Denniston on the plateau a bit further south from Stockton. I took part in the resource consent hearing for that, and it is an extraordinary ecology on that plateau. Very unusual range of species, both plants and animals, that you don't find other places. And quite a beautiful area, really. But it's also an awful lot of carbon dioxide would come from that coal. 6 million tonnes is one thing. And that's all they applied for, and they, at the resource consent hearing, they're saying, oh, you know, it's only a little bit of this area of amazing ecology that we want to dig up. But when you see their PowerPoint presentation to an industry conference, you see a map of that plateau with 8 big circles on it, each of them a proposed mine. They say they believe there's between 120 and 160 million tonnes of coal up there, and they want the lot. And so they propose to go from one mine to the next to the next. That consent was granted by the commissioners for the regional council, but it is under appeal, and a number of groups are involved in appealing it. And one thing that they're trying to argue is, how do you deal with climate change under the Resource Management Act? That's quite an interesting legal question. Okay, so that's coking coal. In the Waikato, we've had thermal coal, the sort of thing that you burn in power stations and industry, mind for a long time around Huntly, Maramarua, such places. And Solid Energy is getting into a new technology there called underground coal gasification, where you can't get the mine, the coal out either economically or safely for some reason. It's quite well, quite a long way underground. Maybe it's below the water table and that's why you can't easily mine it. Anyway, they section it off in sealed chambers and set fire to it underground and capture the gas. It's burned with very little oxygen so that it doesn't completely burn, and you get something called synthesis gas, which is, contains quite a lot of methane, which is natural gas, a bit of hydrogen, a bit of carbon monoxide. And then that gas can be used as a power station fuel or as an industrial fuel. Solid Energy is just experimenting with that at the moment. But there have been some horrendous stories from Australia where they're doing that in Queensland. And in fact, local people have just managed to get one big underground coal gasification project closed down because it was extracting toluene and xylene, which are very poisonous carcinogenic chemicals, from the coal, and they were ending up in the underground water supply, and they were ending up in the bodies of the cows that grazed nearby. So there are a lot of serious worries to ask about underground coal gasification. Then we moved to Southland, which is where you started, where 80% of all of New Zealand's coal resources are in the form of lignite, and mainly in Southland and a bit in central Otago. Now, some people say lignite isn't really coal at all. It's so low grade, it hasn't matured very much beyond peat. It's brown, it's more than half water, you can see the plant fibres in it. It's very low quality stuff to burn, and therefore it's very polluting. We've known for decades that we had all this lignite in Southland, but it's never been economic to do much with it, and sort of hasn't been needed. There have been various studies in the past, and they've all said, oh, not worth mining the stuff. Just by the way, it's doing quite a good job at the moment. It's propping up some of the best farmland in the country in Southland, which is quite a rich region from farming. Anyway, Solid Energy has projects to dig up and convert about half of that 6 billion tonnes. We're talking billions here, not millions. This is really, really huge. The first thing they're doing is they've got consent to build a pilot plant to squeeze the water out of the lignite to turn it into briquettes. Now, it's not economic to transport lignite any great distance because so much of it's water. But if you can squeeze the water out and make it into briquettes, which are lighter and a higher energy value, then it can be economic to transport it. And they want to sell that to dairy factories and other industrial consumers. This is what they call a very small pilot plant. They're only mining about 140,000 tonnes a year of lignite to feed it. But in a year's time, all going well for them, they want to build one 10 times bigger. That would be mining 1.4 million tonnes a year of lignite to turn into briquettes, and those would be mainly for export. That's their first type of project. The second thing they want to do shortly after that is to turn lignite into urea. Urea is the nitrogen fertiliser that we use increasingly on our farms, especially our dairy farms, and which makes possible very much higher stocking rates, a lot more cows to the hectare, and therefore a lot more runoff into the rivers. And so urea, both directly and indirectly, is responsible for the high nitrogen levels in our rivers that make the water unsafe to drink or in some cases swim in because of all the animal excrement that goes in with it. That's partly for New Zealand use. You can just imagine there'll be a big push for New Zealand farms to use even more urea than they do now, and a lot of it will be for export. And the third one is the worst of all. The third one is to ultimately make all of New Zealand's diesel from lignite. Now, it's technically possible. South Africa did it during the apartheid era when they couldn't import oil. Germany did it in the war when there was a bit of a blockade trying to stop oil getting to Germany. So you can convert coal and low-grade lignite into petroleum products, particularly diesel. And Solid Energy says it can supply all of New Zealand's diesel from lignite. The first plant would supply only about half of that. And the impact of that is if you burn a litre of diesel made from lignite in your vehicle, the overall greenhouse gases coming from that will be twice what happens when you burn a litre of diesel made from petroleum in your vehicle. So highly polluting. Then, of course, there's all the local pollution. It's a question of the health effects of what happens when people have to live close to coal mines, the dust, the particulates, there's noise, there's the traffic disturbance, there's the loss of high-quality farmland. So quite a lot of people in Southland are concerned about these projects. Other people think it's the greatest thing that's ever happened to the region. They're going to be very wealthy, they're going to have lots of jobs. And so there's a bit of a division in the community down there. So that's the overall picture of what's happening. The question is, why does it matter if we dig up this much fossil fuel? Well, some people may remember that James Hansen, probably the world's foremost climate scientist, was visiting here in May and did a speaking tour around New Zealand. He's done the calculations that show, first of all, that if we're to have a safe climate where we're not at risk of starting a runaway melting of the ice caps, which, if that happened, would raise sea level 25 metres, a safe level is to get carbon dioxide in the atmosphere back down to 350 parts per million. It's currently at 394. So it means that rather than putting more up there, we've actually got to take some out by sequestering more of it in trees and soil and so forth. He says that to get to 350 over the next 50 years, we have to stop using coal altogether. That we can burn the remaining conventional, easily mined oil and gas. I mean, we're going to do that anyway. It's hard to see how you could ever stop that. But first, we've got to phase out coal to zero in the next 20 years. And then we've got to stop looking for oil and gas in more extreme places, like under the sea, like underground gasification, like fracking, which we haven't mentioned but could come back to, like in the Arctic, all these crazy places that people are trying to find oil now that the conventional sources are starting to run out. So if we're phasing out coal over 20 years, a sensible way to do that with the minimum harm to anybody in the industry would be you keep your current mines going until they run out of coal, which they'll do within the 20 years. You don't open any new ones, and you don't send any more people into that industry. People who are in the industry now can keep their jobs until they retire. You gradually just run down your coal mining as the mines deplete. But instead of that, we've got proposals to open new mines all over the place. There's this great race on for who can extract the most fossil fuels, and the government is backing it 100%. In fact, they're driving it. That was a bit of a long introduction, but there you go.
That's right. And in the meantime, we've got a campaign, we've got many people endeavouring to educate the public on what is happening. And you have also Coal Action Network, aotearoa.wordpress.com. How is the ground support building for this, to get people aware and to take action, Jeanette?
Well, CANA, or Coal Action Network Aotearoa, works by having a small core group of people who organise things, and a large network of people who sign up to get email advice of what is happening and what they can do to help. About a year ago, we had 35 people on that list. We've now got well over 1,000. We want to build it to 10,000 at least, so that when the messages go out, and I must say, every month there's a very informative newsletter goes out about what's happening with coal, things that are on, things you can do, places you can find more information. Really, really worthwhile. So I would encourage listeners who want to know more about what's happening with coal in New Zealand to sign up through the CANA website, as you said, coalactionnewzealand.wordpress.com. And, for example, we're having workshops at the moment on strategy, what's the smart way to tackle this, whose behaviour are we trying to change and how do you do that. We have a cross-groups telephone call once a month of all the groups in New Zealand that are working on coal, who get together on a telephone conference call and just share what they've been doing, new information, research and so forth, which we've found very helpful. CANA's one of those. We've also got, you know, Greenpeace and WWF and ECO and some younger people's groups like 350.org and Generation Zero, all into coal and all with their own niche of things to do about it. There's going to be a week in October, starting on the 17th, when all the Lush stores in New Zealand are going to have a week's profiling of CANA. We actually need volunteers to help with that, but that's going to be a great way of reaching the public about what we're doing. We're planning a summer festival in January. This will be a really fun event over 3.5 days. And guess where we're having it? We're having it on the farm of the only farmer in his area of Southland who has not sold his farm to Solid Energy and is not selling his farm to Solid Energy, no matter how much they pressure him. And he lives just 0.5 kilometre from where the pilot briquetting plant is being built. So we're going to camp on that farm. We're going to have workshops and videos, and there'll be music in the evenings. It's family-friendly, big cook-ups. And on the Sunday, we'll have an open day in Matara in the hall to engage with the local community. We'll have a number of speakers on lignite and health, lignite and the economy, lignite and climate change, and inviting local groups in Matara to come and run stalls. There'll be a lot of displays to look at. There'll be people selling food. Just a community day where those of us really concerned about lignite and with a message to share about that get to engage with the local people and hear their view of things, what concerns them and how we might help. So that's taking a lot of planning at the moment. To register for that camp, registration actually isn't open yet, but if you get on the email list for CANA, then you'll be told when registration is open. So that's at Matara.
What about the corporates? Are you finding anyone like these? There's this Sustainable Business Network, etc., and other businesses involved in sustainability. Are they prepared to put their head up above the parapet and call this out, or are they remaining quiet?
Well, Sustainable Business Network tends to be mainly smaller businesses who want to be sustainable, and they are pretty clear that they don't support a coal-based future for New Zealand, so they're pretty upfront and direct. There's also the Sustainable Business Council in New Zealand, which is not going to be able to say anything because they have Solid Energy as a member, and I haven't actually heard anything from them for a very long time. I'm not sure whether they're still in existence. Then you've got this new group calling itself Pure Advantage, which is a group of quite enlightened business leaders, and they are leaders of large businesses, who say New Zealand's big strategic economic advantage in selling to the rest of the world is its clean green brand, and that we should be focusing on protecting that clean green brand and making it real, and we should be focusing on a low carbon economy with a lot of developments in what they call clean tech or green tech. In other words, technologies that don't damage the planet, but that still produce wealth. So those people are very clear that they do not see a role for coal expansion in their vision of what the future could be like, New Zealand taking advantage of its big marketing advantage of being seen as clean and green. Which, of course, it isn't really. Compared with some countries, it's somewhat better. But we could be so much better than we are, and that's what they're trying to achieve. And they're trying to put pressure on government to say, look, this is the way forward for New Zealand, not more fossil fuels.
Yes, because we need to have our pillars of society. We need to have our civic elders and our responsible business leaders standing up for the future and standing up for our children. Yes, one of the things that I have yet to hear is that why isn't there no gigantic superannuation forestry fund that all New Zealanders can put money towards so that we can pull all the CO2 out of the atmosphere and restore the ecology, particularly the soil, etc., and particularly in the case of having long life trees like 600-year-old rimu trees or Tanikaha or Kaihikatea, where we can actually unify the country around something that's very pro-future, it's very pro-children, and it's pro-environment. Has anybody sort of brought this subject matter up?
Well, of course, there is a big superannuation fund that is invested in forestry in New Zealand, but unfortunately, New Zealanders can't join it. We sold a large part of the Kaingaroa Forest to the Harvard Business School Superannuation Fund, and most of our forests are now overseas owned. In terms of planting new ones, you talked about long-lived trees, 600-year-old rimus. Well, the challenge we've got there is if you put your superannuation money in something, you expect to get a return on it when you retire to live on. 600-year-old rimu trees aren't going to give you any return on your investment except a beautiful forest to look at because you don't cut them down. Well, certainly don't cut them down in any time frame we might be interested in. Hopefully you don't cut them down at all. The forestry that does give you some return on your investment is pine forests. And we have so much pine forest in New Zealand already. And, of course, that only sequesters carbon until you cut it down. And then it all gets released back to the atmosphere. And, yes, if you replant again in the same place, it starts sequestering carbon again. But you never get any more carbon captured than you capture in that first 25 years. And then you've got to maintain it in forest forever by constantly replanting just to keep that amount of carbon out of the atmosphere. There is a project that was set up by government in 2002, announced in 2002, called the Permanent Forest Sinks Initiative, where you can get carbon credits for planting a forest that you commit never to cut down, and it is not pine, it's longer-lived species. Now, some of them are natives, some of them are things like Douglas fir or eucalypts, and you can selectively log by taking out trees as they mature as long as you maintain a closed canopy. So as you can harvest kind of at the rate of growth, but not obviously for quite a few years. That would not be economic except that you can get carbon credits for doing it, which are saleable internationally, at least as long as there is a carbon market. That is, I think, something very much to be encouraged compared with just planting pines and then logging them again. And, of course, we do have doubts about what perpetual rotations of pine forests will do to the soil. It does tend to acidify the soil. We perhaps haven't been doing it for long enough to know yet. We're on a third rotation now, and there are some questions about what acres and acres of just pines will do to the soil. Yeah, we also need to look at how to store more carbon in soils. That's a win-win. The more carbon there is in your soil, the more fertile it is for growing food. If you sequester it in soil in the right way, it stays there for a very, very long time. There's research going into what's called biochar, where you can grow a tree and then charcoalize it in a particular way and bury it in the soil, and it's good for the soil, and it also locks that carbon away, and you grow another tree in the same space. That's in its infancy of research, but it does show some promise. Of course, organic farming methods, which rely a lot on building soil humus, which is after all carbon, through composting and other techniques, do tend to store more carbon than mineral farming, which just adds urea and mineral phosphate fertilizers, and the soil can get quite depleted of carbon over time. I mean, that depends a bit on how good a farmer you are, but organic farming does tend to store more carbon in the soil than non-organic farming, and that's something we should encourage too, because of course there's a big market overseas for organic produce.
Well, it's a huge one, and a regrettable thing, and I've mentioned it on this radio station numerous times, that our government is not languaging these words like organic, like ecology, of commerce, of using the word sustainability in an ecological or environmental context. And so when you have the leading institutions and government not really pushing the ecological viewpoint that we need to be far more sustainable at this level, it's a big challenge, isn't it?
Yes, well, I don't think government really believes in that stuff.
I agree, they don't.
So they're certainly not pushing it. In fact, they impede it in many ways.
Yes, it's a huge one. The other thing is, of course, and it's a small thing, but I do want to mention it. I can go into many shops today and I can see refrigerators and they only have 2 stars, and yet there's 5 stars on the actual refrigerator. So we're buying a lot of cheap whiteware and cheap technology, and so we're drawing a lot of energy into these units. Admittedly, this is, you know, removed from the coal side at the moment, but we'll get back to that. This is still also a big problem. We're not having a government saying, let's see if we can get the highest quality products in.
Well, I can give you a ray of hope there. A 1-star refrigerator is the lowest efficiency refrigerator that is legal in New Zealand. But since we brought in minimum energy performance standards, the worst ones are not legal in New Zealand anymore. So even the 1- and 2-star refrigerators are quite a lot better than what used to come in before, I don't want to blow my own trumpet here, but before my private member's bill, which was the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Act, was passed in 2000. Up till that time, there was no legal way for anybody to set minimum energy performance standards for appliances in New Zealand. Then they started doing it. They've saved New Zealand consumers about, well, this is a few years old now, this figure, $163 million it was then, in saved electricity costs from upgrading appliances. So, yes, we could push those standards higher and faster. It's been particularly good for refrigerators, but the fact that you can get a 5-star refrigerator, I've actually never seen a 5-star refrigerator in New Zealand. I suppose they exist. But means that you can do a whole lot better than the 1 or 2 stars that you're seeing. But even the 1 or 2 stars are a whole lot better than what used to be there. We could push energy efficiency standards a whole lot faster. It's a real win-win. The consumer saves money over the lifetime of the appliance, and the country saves energy and the cost of the next power station. And if the power stations are thermal, using fossil fuels, then we save carbon dioxide emissions as well.
Very good. I'm speaking with Jeanette Fitzsimons on ecological concerns here in New Zealand, in particular the mining of low-grade lignite coal in Southland. Jeanette, you mentioned fracking, and I feel we need to get to that one because it's disconcerting.
Yes, and this is something I've only come across relatively recently as well. Fracking actually is shorthand for hydrofracturing. The natural gas that we've mined in the past tends to occur in sands or rock with loose particles where the gas is in the spaces between the particles of the rock. You put down a well and the gas is under pressure and it shoots up the well, oil the same, and you take it out. Well, we've just about finished all of the gas and oil fields where it's under pressure and it comes out easily like that in a sort of a loose or open rock formation. And gas that people are going after now is trapped in very tight sands or in shale where it's sort of within the rock and it's very hard to get it out. In order to access the gas that is in shale rock, they drill this deep well, and then they go out sideways from the well and they force water with about 3% chemicals in it, some of which are very toxic. They force that water under great pressure into the rock and it kind of explodes the rock and makes channels. It fractures the rock and it makes channels that the gas can flow out from the shale. And some wells in the United States, they frack, you know, they do one of these fracturing things every year or two to open up more pathways. Some areas of the United States have got a well with fracking going on every kilometre or so, all over a large area of land. And the problem has been, well, there are two problems identified. In the United States, there are some appalling stories of how toxic chemicals that they use with the water to open up the rock, which includes toluene and xylene and hexavalent chromium, among others, that they have been migrating into aquifers, ending up in the water supply. We've had animals poisoned and we've had people made extremely sick in Pennsylvania and some other states in the US. There is a film going around at the moment that a lot of people have seen called Gaslands, which shows some of the things that can go wrong and have gone wrong, and how people are paid maybe a couple of $1,000 to sign permission to drill on their land, and then after that they've got no rights at all and their water is polluted and their animals are dying and they're sick, and they're mostly poor people and they've just got nowhere to go and no recourse. Fracking's been going on in New Zealand and Taranaki for quite a long time in association with the gas wells down there, and so far I haven't heard of any poisoning of water supplies. The Taranaki Regional Council does not require you to get a consent to frack, but you do have to get a consent to dispose of the sludge that comes up out of the well later and the fracking fluids. They seem to spread that sludge on land. They call it land farming, and then they seem to grow grass over the top and graze cattle, which I would have thought was a very dangerous thing to do. They've also heard that the worst of the chemicals that have caused problems in the US, particularly those three I mentioned, are actually not allowed in New Zealand. But look, there's a huge amount more that I don't know about this technology than there is that I know. I know a number of people are digging into it at the moment, and we haven't actually found serious ill effects yet in New Zealand, but a lot of people are quite worried about what will happen to the water in their neighbourhood, particularly people in Taranaki. The other thing that fracking has been accused of is triggering earthquakes. Just recently I saw a report where in the UK a couple of earthquakes were linked to fracking, and the fracking's been stopped in the meantime. Now, nobody's claiming that the Christchurch earthquake is the result of fracking. I don't even think there's any going on down there. the earthquakes that are accused of being triggered by fracking have generally been smallish ones, but interfering with the stability of the geology of the earth is something I think you should really beware of, and that's a concern people have too. Underground coal gasification and underground and coal seam methane, which is another underground technology, may be associated with fracking. We haven't been able to find out much about what's happening there. So this is, while it's not a new technology, the concerns about it are quite new, and we're still investigating in New Zealand.
We've got our hands full, really, haven't we?
Well, I often feel, Tim, it's like the Hydra. You know, you go and you deal with one application somewhere, and while your back's turned, six more have popped up all over the country. You know, I thought I was going to be working on Southland Lignite, and then this Denniston coking coal thing pops up, so I go and I deal with that, and I think I'm handling both Lignite and Denniston, and then I suddenly find out about underground coal gasification not that far from where I live in the Waikato, and if a fracking thing comes along, and you start to think, this is going to take a big citizens' movement, because I'm absolutely convinced we are not going to win this by persuading solid energy it's a bad idea. We're not going to win any battle like this by persuading people who think they can make money out of it to stop. So how are we going to win it? Well, possibly by persuading the people that put up the money that it's not a good investment, or politically by showing that the majority of New Zealanders are so concerned about what is being done to the future of their children and grandchildren that they are prepared to get out and make a statement on it and put their bodies on the line and march on the streets. And that kind of direct action, I think, is the only thing that's going to change things in New Zealand. Yeah, we had a very easy win over mining in national parks. A very easy win. I wasn't expecting it to be nearly so quick and easy. But when 40,000 people got out and marched in Auckland, John Key said, "Oh shit!" And all of a sudden he said, "Okay, that's all off. We're not going to mine in national. We're not going to mine in national parks or Schedule C areas, but we're going to redouble our efforts to mine on all the rest of conservation land," which is what people didn't quite realise at the time. You know, this Denniston mine, this is conservation land up on the Denniston Plateau. It's highly valuable ecology, but the government is encouraging Bathurst to get in there and dig up the coal from underneath. So we've got a big fight on our hands. It's not going to be won in Parliament, although it's useful if the debate happens in Parliament. It's not going to be won with polite conversations in the head office of Solid Energy. It's going to be won when enough people show they care. And, you know, grandparents are really getting into this now. We've got a new movement in New Zealand which is gaining force. It's called G-Force. And you know about that one?
Yes, well, we talked about it about 3 weeks ago, and I did put it through in my Earth files and just before it was to be kicked in. And yes, it's grands and geriatrics and
great uncles and great aunts and great people and grumpies and anything else beginning with G. People who are concerned about the future for today's children. Now, I've got two grandchildren. They're 6 and 3, and they are just incredibly important in my life. And when I think about what they're going to be facing, you know, they could still be alive at the end of this century if they live as long as my father did. And by the end of the century, we can expect a likelihood of a metre of sea level rise and the possibility of 2. And the knowledge that if the 2 big ice sheets go, then the sea will rise by about 5 metres per century until it gets to 25 metres. You start thinking about what 25 metres of sea level rise means to most of our coastal communities, they're gone. You start thinking about what that does to our economy. You start thinking about whether your grandchildren will ever be able to get a job. You start thinking about the shortage of food that's going to be around the world from climate change. It's starting already. Food prices have gone up massively internationally of staples, the sorts of things that the poor people need to buy, not the luxuries. And, I mean, the key impacts of climate change are shortage of fresh water because of changes in rainfall patterns, disappearance of ice in glaciers and at the poles. The ice in the Himalayan glaciers provides the fresh water for a quarter of the world's people. It's not going to be there. Then there's acidification of the oceans, which, when it really gets going, will undermine our fisheries, so we get fisheries collapse. Then there's increased storms and droughts and floods, so that you might have finally established a wonderful crop of something and the next big storm wipes it out. This is a recipe for extreme instability and uncertainty and insecurity in life, and people are really going to suffer. I don't want that for the next generation. You know, our generation's had it pretty good. Our generation's probably been the luckiest ever. We've had jobs, we've had income, we've had a good environment, we've had, you know, on average, we've done extremely well. We've had political freedom. All of those things are starting to disappear now. And we need to take action now if we're going to leave a world for our grandchildren that is, it won't be as good as the world that we've lived in, but if we're going to leave one that is as good as possible, we need to start work, right? We really needed to start work 20 years ago, but we didn't. And so it becomes even more urgent to start now because there's not much time left.
We're too complacent in New Zealand. That is our problem. When you go overseas and experience what it's like in Asia or in certain places in South America or in the Middle East, boy, the environmental concerns and the massive population base over there, we here in New Zealand, we're living in a dreamland, really.
Yes, it does seem all too easy.
That's right. Now, another problem, Jeanette, here in researching this topic, there is so much anger and resentment towards people who equate greenhouse gases to global warming. And this is the war between the so-called warmists and the denialists. And you must have come up against them often. And it's not gone away. And many people, and I include myself in this, have no idea where our taxes are really going, read the emissions trading scheme, the ETS. Most critics state that there's no transparent paper trail and that some large carbon traders, some out of Chicago, are cornering the market with a huge amount of money. Can you shed any light on this?
Well, you've got two distinct questions there, Tim.
I agree.
The question of the argument between a 95 or something percent of the world's scientists, or particularly those trained in climate science, and the small number of denialists, that's one thing. Second one is the emissions trading scheme working? Is it the right scheme to have? And the answer is very different. First of all, I think we have the media to blame a lot for their concept of balance is that if you've got a reputable scientific finding that's been published in a peer-reviewed journal and is backed by 95% of the world's scientists, and you've got a small handful of deniers who say it's wrong and have an alternative explanation which has never been published or peer-reviewed, then they get equal space in the media and it's presented as though on the one hand this, on the other hand the other. It's like we used to do that, I suppose, once upon a time with the people who thought the Earth was flat. We don't. There is still a flat Earth society. There are still people who believe that the globe is not round and that the Earth is flat. But we don't give them equal space in the newspapers with the rest of us. And we've got to get to that stage. There are some things people need to know about the people who are trying to rubbish climate science. First of all, the PR agencies employed to put the denialist's perspective are the same PR agencies that for decades were putting the case that tobacco doesn't cause any health problems. And long after the science was absolutely fixed on tobacco and lung cancer, heart disease and so forth, these people were still pushing out this nonsense about actually tobacco's all right, it doesn't do you any harm. And they're just there for hire. Secondly, there are some very wealthy vested interests behind the denialist perspective, ExxonMobil being the biggest one. Big fossil fuel companies. The Koch brothers in the United States, who are sort of oil fossil fuel billionaires, who fund the Republican Party big time, and who have put a huge amount into the climate denialist camp, huge amount of money. The next thing about it is that the playing field is not level. If you've got one bunch of people telling you things are very worrying, we are all going to need to change the way we live in order to have a future for our grandchildren, and you've got another bunch of people, even if they're only tiny and they're wrong, telling you you've got nothing to worry about, just keep on burning, there's no problem, you really want to believe the second group, don't you? I mean, nobody, I don't want to believe that climate science is as bad as it is. I don't want to believe that we're headed for disaster if we don't do something. It would be much, much more comfortable just to say, oh, that's all a lot of nonsense. I'll just believe them. So they've even said, you know, the denialist industry have even said our business is just to sow uncertainty. Our business is doubt. We don't have to prove anything. We just have to throw some doubt on what the climate scientists are saying, and then we've won, because people will find it so much easier to believe us than to believe the horrible truth. So you've got a very unbalanced sort of situation there. And there are people who've got nothing better to do than go on every blog site and every website, and their arguments have all been found wanting so many times. They say, oh, it's actually not human emissions at all, it's sunspots. Well, all the IPCC scenarios have totally controlled for solar activity to see whether that could have caused it, and it couldn't. In fact, the time of really, really rapid warming recently has coincided with the time of lowest solar activity, with the solar minimum. So that idea is thoroughly discredited. And the same with all the rest of them. So I just don't give them any time. I don't bother arguing with them any longer. It just uses up time and energy that we need to put into doing something. Then you asked about the ETS, the Emissions Trading System. I think the ETS is a scam. I don't think it isn't doing anything to reduce emissions, and I don't think it ever will, with the exception of it is encouraging some more people to plant forests, and I suppose there's some benefit from that. But in terms of energy users, it's far too weak to have any real impact in terms of the price signal. The theory, of course, behind emissions trading is if you put a price on emitting carbon and say it's going to cost you this much to let a ton of carbon dioxide go into the sky, then you're going to look at how you can change your technology or your process to emit less. And however, if you're an aluminium smelter and it's actually quite difficult for you to use less because of the way your process works, if you can find somebody for whom it is much cheaper to reduce carbon, you can purchase some of their carbon and let them do the work of reducing it. And that means you get the greatest reductions for the least cost. That's the theory. But it actually doesn't really work like that at all. For one thing, you've got far too many loopholes and far too many concessions. Most big New Zealand industry gets 90% of its emissions for free and only has to pay for the last 10%. So that's not a very strong price penalty. Then the price penalty is only half from now until the end of next year. It's linked to your output. So if you produce twice as much steel next year as you did this year, you get twice as many free credits. So the whole thing is not really geared to have any effect on emissions at all. The people who will get really wealthy out of the emissions trading scheme are the people, the traders, the speculators. Just like in the, you can speculate in currency, in the New Zealand currency, buy when it's cheap and sell when it's expensive, make your money that way. We can think of somebody quite sort of senior in New Zealand who made his millions that way, can't we? Anyway, that doesn't create any more wealth from anywhere. That just takes it off someone else. And the people who, if you're in the carbon market, the best way for you to make money is not to waste any time trying to reduce your emissions, but first of all, to spend it lobbying the government to be let off, because that has worked brilliantly. The biggest lobby groups have been let off. And secondly, spend your time looking around the world and find where carbon credits are really cheap, like some of the developing country clean development mechanisms, where you can buy really cheap carbon credits, and then sell them to people for a higher price, or speculate in the market. So the first ETS that came in at the end of 2008 was, I decided, marginally better than nothing. Only marginally. But it was very different from what we've got now. When the new government came in, 2008 election, in 2009 it changed the scheme a lot, made it a whole lot weaker, and crucially it brought in that mechanism whereby if you expand production, you get more free credits. Whereas the initial scheme that Labor brought in, your free credits were a transitional thing, and they were linked to what your production was in 2005. And if you expanded production or built a new factory, you had to cover the whole cost of your increased emissions. And that was a much stronger driver to move New Zealand towards low-carbon technology. But that's all gone now. So I think we do need a price on carbon. If you don't have a price on carbon, then fossil fuels are always going to be cheaper than renewables. And so fossil fuels are what people are going to use. You know, if it's cheap, people will burn it. So you need a price on carbon. You need a high price on carbon. But it needs to be transparent and direct and straightforward with no exceptions. You could do that much better by having a carbon tax, a carbon charge, and that would raise a heap of money, which you could then give back to the people as an equal citizen's dividend or as an equal tax rate for everybody, so that people would have more money in their pockets, and it would cost them more to use fossil fuels. But if they were careful in what they did and didn't use a lot of fossil fuel and used renewables or used energy efficiently, they'd be better off. And the people who were careless or who used a lot of fossil fuels would be worse off. It's exactly the sort of incentive you want. The trouble with the ETS is it doesn't raise any money for government. The money passes from the person who buys the credit to the person who sells the credit, and they make off with it. So there's nothing to give back to the people who were the source of the money in the first place.
Jeanette, thank you very much for coming on the show this morning.
Thanks, Tim.
That was Jeanette Fitzsimons, and the website is coalactionnetworkaotearoa.com. WordPress.com.